This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Tonight, what we're going to do is take prevention to the relatively far end of the lifespan, talking about issues towards the end of life that benefit from prevention, as well as treatments that we'll also cover. We've highlighted three particularly important problems of older Americans, dementia, osteoporosis, and urinary dysfunction. And we'll do that in the context of some basic principles of how healthcare for older individuals is different and why prevention remains an important part of care throughout the entire lifestyle. Our speaker tonight is Eliseo Perez Estable. Eliseo and I trained together here at UCSF in 1978 when we were fortunate. I had been a medical student and joined the residency here. We were fortunate enough, or our bosses were fortunate enough, to recruit Eliseo from the University of Miami, where he had been an outstanding medical student there. And he's been at UCSF since then as a medical resident, as a fellow in general internal medicine and health disparities, as one of our key faculty, a leader of our primary care internal medicine residency program, and then for the last many years, our chief of general internal medicine here at UCSF. This is the division, the academic home, if you will, of all the faculty who have spoken at this course, and one of the central homes to those faculty who think about issues related to prevention here at UCSF. Eliseo is what we call a quadruple threat at UCSF. He's an outstanding clinician. He continues to see patients and has throughout his career, almost never misses a week. Wednesday is his day. I always know that. So it was a particular pleasure to get him to come tonight because he's already had a very busy day in the office. He's one of our outstanding and most honored teachers, particularly with our house staff, but also with our fellows, both our clinical fellows and our research fellows. Probably most importantly has been his leadership skills as chair of our Division of General Internal Medicine and his research skills. Eliseo has developed a very innovative research career in health disparities, looking at many aspects of the impact that race and ethnicity and class and education and other factors, other social determinants of health, have on health outcomes, including particularly preventive services. So he's done very innovative work both here in the United States in many of our communities, but also internationally with important projects, and particularly in Latin America. For that work, he's been elected to be a member of the most prestigious medical society in the United States, the Institute of Medicine, and has really received numerous honors, including the highest award that our Society of General Internal Medicine gives to our faculty. So you're really in for a treat. He's an expert on all of these subjects. He has a lot of material. I know he'll get through it all for you. It's all been sent electronically and it'll be posted on our website. For those of you, if we go fast, there'll be plenty of time to look at it a second and third time. I think you'll find it quite interesting. We've entitled it, What Can We Do to Prevent Dementia, Osteoporosis, and Urinary Dysfunction? Eliseo?
Thank you, Bobby. It's a real pleasure to be with you this evening. And I'm going to take you through these topics as a medical learners, but understanding that you're not. And so we'll try to really focus on the things that are of general interest. But so you'll get a taste of what we try to teach on these issues from a generalist perspective. These are all, as you may note, areas of sub-specialization for different types of physicians. Although as general internal medicine, we do the nuts and bolts of this all the time. I'm not going to focus on issues around health disparities or race ethnicity today. It's just not part of this this topic. So here's what I hope to cover. The most important part at the beginning is really to talk about the paradigm of what happens when we care for elder older adults. And it's not just 65, that's Medicare and that's Social Security. And it's all relative because now 65 is really not, people get to 65, they still got a long ways to go and they're pretty healthy. Many people are pretty healthy. It's 75, it's 85 and so forth. The medication overuse and avoidance is a brief but important point. Then we'll talk about dementia, mostly in the area of recognition management. I'll give you what we know about prevention. Falls, which is a critically important problem with older adults, and that leads to fractures, which is caused by having weak bones or osteoporosis. And finally, a brief overview of urinary dysfunction. I do hope to get through it and leave time for questions at the end. So geriatric principles, the first thing to think, keep in mind is that we're focusing on quality of life and not quantity or prolongation. That's off the table pretty much, even though doctors and patients frequently are still focused on that. No one has one problem. Everyone has multiple problems. Now, there are occasional exceptions to this, of course, but comorbidity, as we call it, means multiple chronic problems. Functional status should be part of our vital signs, and I'll tell you more about what that means. Cognitive status affects us all. 50% of people over the age of 84 have detectable or measurable cognitive dysfunction. So this is not just, oh, a disease. This is something that happens as we age. When you get sick, care across settings becomes an important area. So you're home, you get sick, you go to the hospital, you go to a skilled nursing facility, you go back home. And eventually some people end up in a long-term care facility. And this is, again, a big topic in healthcare of older adults. And then palliative care, symptom management for people who have limited life expectancy. And that's a whole topic in and of itself, which I'm not going to get into in great detail, but it's, again, to keep you, where are the big issues when I see in taking care of older adults? And we'll cover a couple more of these. So cognitive status, it's sort of the holy grail of geriatrics. It's why aging care and geriatrics and aging research exist. The end outcome of all diseases in some ways. It really matters on how much your functional status is affected and impacts the natural history of this. And when we talk about functional status, I refer to things as ADL and IDL, and I'll define these for you in the next slide. So these are pretty basic things that everybody will understand. So activities of daily living means that you dress, you transfer, that means you can move from bed to chair, or from chair you get up to the table, toilet needs, bathing, and feeding yourself. So pretty basic function. And we should be asking all of those things of all our patients after a certain point, because this is actually as important as taking the blood pressure or the weight, and more important than some of the things we end up doing. People who end up in a nursing home or long-term care facility, institution, have usually at least two of these functions are impaired. And it's in the 80-85% range of adults who are in chronic care facilities have impairment in at least two of these. A lot of people with these impairments are home, which is another issue. Instrumental activities of daily living are the things you need to do to function, besides functioning to manage your own care. So finances, transportation within the community, shopping and preparing food, buying clothing, using a phone, and now I would add a computer, housework, and handling your own medications. And those tend to go earlier, and people do benefit from help, whether maybe it's only finances in some cases, sometimes it's other things, from either family members, caregivers. And there's a whole area now of caregiver interest because there's a large number of people doing it. It's an area of research and a policy area in healthcare that we need to focus on. So functional status should be part of what we do routinely. And one other measurement that I think has been borne out by research is gait speed. And this is something that you can operationalize in a clinical practice as something called a get-up-and-go test, where you have someone get up from a sitting position and walk a certain distance, and you time them. And there are standards by which one can measure it. And it is a predictor of lots of outcomes in the future. Sort of asking someone, well, how good is your health? Similarly has that kind of predictive value. Evaluating cognitive status, establishing decision makers for goals of care. So that means someone who knows what you would want if you get really sick what your wishes would be. Someone needs to know that. Now, it's usually a spouse or an adult son or daughter or a very close friend, partner, but I think that's something that we need to prioritize that patients need to do. And then using functional status as a activities of daily living as an outcome. So if this therapy will make you do better at these things, that's a good intervention. And we're not just talking about preventing death or preventing or prolonging life. I think that the dynamics change at a certain point. And there's no, like I said again, there's no magical age that this shifts into that. And it varies according to the individual. I already kind of covered this. I think the transitions of care is an important policy, healthcare system, and research area, probably only relevant to you if it happens or to your close ones. So I'll just skip over going over this again. And palliative care and symptom management sort of follows along these lines. The idea that says, okay, there's nothing more to do that is curative is a hard thing for most people to hear. And then you say, well, that means you're abandoning me and there's no treatment? No. I think there's lots of treatment to help people manage their symptoms and feel better. And these are interventions that are both on the pharmacological, physical, as well as social and spiritual dimensions that are helpful. And I think this is a very important area, both for hospitalized patients, but also for outpatients, since a lot of people are living outside of the, you know, obviously living outside the hospital, very sick, that need these kinds of services. So let me cover briefly the issue of medications, and this is both for your own personal thinking as well as any friends or people that you know who are older. Medications are a double-edged sword. And we think we've done wonderful things with pharmacological interventions in healthcare problems, as you've probably have heard, hypertension, diabetes, cholesterol. But they can also be harmful. So 90% of people over 65 take medications every day. 46% take five or more. 54% go to more than one doctor to get their medicines. Hopefully not the patients we see, and 35% use more than one pharmacy. Right there, that's a problem. I mean, maybe a mail order and a close one is okay, but not multiple pharmacies otherwise. Older adults use over half of all prescribed medicines, and of course, half do not take medicines as prescribed. So poor adherence or not following all the instructions is common. And there are a lot of people that are suboptimally treated or being treated with suboptimal medicines. Because of this, people have looked at this as a research question or as a policy question and found that a lot of bad outcomes come from medication use. A quarter of outpatient practices report problems with adverse drug effects. 10 to 17% of hospital admissions to the hospital are due to adverse drug effects. Adverse drug effects is disproportionately affecting elderly, and there's a greater predictor is purely the number of medicines. So when I, as a clinician, am prescribing medicines to patients and I count how many prescription medicines are they on, I mean, if it's 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, you're increasing the risk of a problem. At the same time that I'm trying to treat things, so one has to really pause and think: do I really need this, or what is the cost of keep people on multiple chronic prescription medicines? So there is a website, this AmericanGeriatrics.org, that's called the Beers Criteria. It's a last name, nothing to do with beer, and it gets updated periodically. This is from 2012, 2013, and their goal is to reduce inappropriate medicine. So they created categories of medicines that we doctors should avoid regardless, no matter what, in older adults. You can always say there's always some exception. It's inappropriate with certain diseases or syndromes. And then a category, let's say, use with caution. And if you go there and you look at even the use with caution, you'd be surprised to see medicines that we are commonly prescribing or using in the population. So there is a sort of a watch function to this, which I think is very helpful for doctors to learn, but anyone can go look at. So let's now switch to dementia. Dementia, as a name, is a little bit of a negative connotation, doesn't it? In Spanish, demente was sort of people who were crazy. It's what it means, and it has this kind of historical kind of sense that patients would react to. So I rarely ever use it in Spanish, in my Spanish-speaking patients. So cognitive impairment is the term I have tended to use in the last number of years as a factual, something people kind of get, at the same time is not specific, like Alzheimer's disease, although everyone understands that, and I don't think, although it has a certain connotation as well, but most people don't feel as emotional about it. The DSM-5 came out with a neurocognitive disorders as the official name, so we can put all three of them there. This is a brief case presentation to illustrate how this can present. So here's an example of a 67-year-old woman with a history of high blood pressure who brought in by her husband because patient's personality has changed over the previous year, becoming more suspicious, at times talks and doesn't make sense. She's paranoid about the neighbors. So on first look, this looks like a psychiatric problem. Someone's paranoid, they're suspicious, their personality's changing. There are some things that one would wonder about. People with, for example, a frontal lobe brain cancer tumor can present with personality change. So one has to think of some things like that. You want to check some blood tests. She's on medicines probably for her high blood pressure. Make sure there's something not unusual, like a sodium that's really low. But actually, this is a fairly typical presentation for early onset Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, if you go back to the original reports of Alzheimer, when he described this, and he was predominantly looking at pathology, they were patients with psychiatric symptoms of paranoia. And for a long time, these patients would show up in the psychiatrist's office until we have a broader sense of how this would present. Alzheimer's is common. It's 24 million people worldwide 10 years ago. Predicted to rise by 42 million by the end of this decade, 80 million by 2040, as we see increase with age to a rate of approaching 20%. And I'll differentiate cognitive impairment, sort of detectable cognitive impairment, which is not impacting your function, from dementia or neurocognitive disorder, which actually affects function. And that's why this is so important, a distinction. And it's huge cost. There was a New England Journal of Medicine article a couple of years ago modeling the cost of dementia care, and it would exceed heart disease care or any diabetes or kidney disease care. So this is a major, major problem that our country and the world faces as we take care of other things. So what are risk factors? Age, okay, can't do anything about that. Down syndrome, so starting off with a disability, with a mental deficiency or disability, is increased risk for cognitive impairment. Traumatic brain injury is turning out to be an important component, and with all that has happened in the last 20 years in terms of war and early onset traumatic injury from accidents, and our incredible ability now to save people's lives from trauma, the people are surviving into, you know, their traumatic brain injury and are now functioning, and this is all a risk for cognitive disorder. Fewer years of formal education. So there's an easy intervention for the world. Everyone get more education. We get everyone to go to school, at least get high school and maybe some, you know, community college, or get a couple of years if you learn a trade. And that will probably impact the rate of cognitive disorder in a longer time. Women have higher risk. Having a family history of Alzheimer's, although those are not always easy to determine. Vascular disease risk factors, separating that from stroke. So strokes, you get a lot of strokes, a lot of mini strokes, that's an increased risk. You get a big stroke, that's a definite risk. You may have a big stroke, your function goes down, and then you're stabilized. And that's the typical pattern that you would see in someone with a stroke, as opposed to a gradual worsening over years, which is what you see with Alzheimer's disease. But just having high cholesterol, smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, and probably, or it's more controversial about obesity, is increased risk, independent of strokes. for cognitive disorders, for dementia. And this is an area of active research that no one, is separating these two, and I think it's important because that may get some people to take their blood pressure medicine. The pathology of the brain, of course, we don't do this in practice, right, because no one gets brain biopsies except for cancer or some very severe inflammation or infections, are these amyloid proteins that get deposited in the brain. They form these neurofibrillary tangles that you can see, I think, illustrated here in this slide here. And all the medical students, we always learned about this because this has been known since the 19th century when Alzheimer's described this in pathological studies. You lose neurons. There is a decrease in cholinergic and serotonergic transmitters in the brain. And so the pursuit of treatments for Alzheimer's has focused on this pathologic finding and the decrease in neurotransmitters as a consequence. That's the drugs that are currently available that function on these neurotransmitters. It may just be a marker and not the cause. We don't really understand all the things that happen, a lot of the things that happen in the brain, in fact, most of the things that happen in the brain. And it's a big black box of networking neurons, and that whole networking component is probably what leads to cognitive disorder, not these neuritic plaques or neurofibrillary tangles. Because people who have perfectly normal cognitive function, when they donate their body to science, you look at their brain, and they may look just like someone who had Alzheimer's with these neurofibrillary tangles, and they never developed it. So this is not necessarily the cause. But this is something that, as everyone learns, is related. So I mentioned that dementia or Alzheimer's disease or neurocognitive disorder is a clinical diagnosis, and it isn't a blood test diagnosis. It isn't an imaging study diagnosis. It's a clinical diagnosis, and it primarily focuses around these criteria. So cognitive change, and that means higher level of functions, so executive things like planning that begin to go. Memory, of course, is what everyone has in mind, but that's one of the symptoms only. Personality change, like the case I presented to you, someone who develops a sudden change in personality, becomes suspicious and develops, in some ways, delusions. Changes in their functioning. These activities that require calculation or planning are the first to be impaired. The psychiatric symptoms, and then problem behaviors. People get up in the middle of the night and go for a walk. People get lost. And people dress inappropriately in places where they normally would have known what to do. And so it is a function, it impacts function. And without that, you don't have dementia. You don't have Alzheimer's disease. You may have memory loss. You may not be all there. Everybody has insight to that. But it's not the same thing. This is a clinical syndrome, well-described and reproducible with criteria. And then we often will say, well, ask caregivers and family and friends and see how they're doing, because that's an important component of all of this. We don't recommend that routinely people be screened, although I haven't met too many folks who are very old who don't say their memory isn't great. So we often end up doing it as a diagnostic screen when someone does complain of it. There are a couple ways of doing this. You could do verbal fluency, which can be to ask a patient to name as many animals as possible in 1 minute. And you get 1 point per animal. And if you score less than 15, you then might want to do other evaluations, other tests. And you adjust that for level of formal education. And just a crude measure, but it's a worthwhile one to know. As a doctor, as a clinician, one needs to know that. So that's a pretty easy one to do. It doesn't take long to do. Another one that... in fact, I just did today, seeing patients, you ask what we call the standard orientation question. So you ask someone, what's today's date? What place are we in? What city? What state? What kind of place? Is this a clinic, a hospital? And then you give someone 3 items to learn and repeat right away. And these are simple items, like table, apple, game. And then ask for recall after you distract him for a minute. So they have a... they learn the words, and then you ask them again a minute later. And you ask them to draw a clock to show the time. And so this is called the mini cog. It's actually been validated. It's used frequently in research as well as in practice. And it's a screening test. It's not a diagnostic. So it tells us if you pass this, you're probably okay. And unless there's other clinical criteria, you don't need to go to further testing. But it's something that we would do to screen for someone's cognitive function. These are sort of the official DSM-5 neurocognitive disorder diagnostic criteria, where they list memory impairment and one of these other functional effects, language problems, motor problems, sensory problems, disturbance in executive functioning. That's really what I would emphasize in all of this. And that it impairs their social occupational function in some way. And that you're also excluding other things. So we always are talking, well, is it something else that's causing this? The most, the one that's most commonly talked about is major depression. People with very severe melancholic major depression can act like they have dementia. But they frequently, there's subtle differences. They may, as you ask someone with cognitive disorders, it's what's today's date? And they'll say, 1930, And someone with the depression might say, I don't know, or I don't remember. They'll just sort of be passive and not proactive about responding. Well, a demented patient will be certain that it's 1930. And then it is a spectrum. And there are measurable mild cognitive impairment, which means you don't do great on some of these tests. You miss on the three recall items. You have a score that's clearly not normal, but not severe. But it has no functional impact. You're still functioning fine. You take care of yourself. You go out on your own. You walk a dog. You do things. So that's not dementia. That becomes mild cognitive impairment, which is much more common than clinical dementia, and a lot of people in their 80s would experience. The case I presented at 67 is kind of young. I mean, that's very unusual to see someone present that young. Usually early 70s is the youngest I personally have seen. There's a proprietary test that is called the Mini-Mental State Exam. It has been used in thousands and thousands of people. So we have pretty good sense of how it works. A maximum score of 30. If you score below 24, it suggests cognitive impairment, and you can see sort of a standard decline over time. The drugs that have been used or are now recommended for dementia have been tested by looking at changes in this score, and it is inversely correlated with age. There are standards that have been used in different race ethnic groups, in Spanish, in Asian, in Chinese, and other languages. It's not as sensitive in people with higher levels of education. I'll give you the brief example of my father, who my sisters were concerned about him, getting dementia, blah, blah, blah. And when he came for a visit, I had one of our neurologists see him to do sort of a shorter version of a memory evaluation. And he scored like 28 on this exam. And he was a physician. For him, it was actually significant because he didn't score 30. And with his level of education, that was probably at age 82 or something like that. So just to give you an example that may look pretty good, but if someone with a very high level of education that could, even just missing a couple of points may be significant. Versus someone with, third grade from Central America, they may be normal for them to be a 25 or 26. So I think these are all things that we consider in thinking about this. There's a non-proprietary test called the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. Again, it's downloadable at that website. It's free. You can look at that. It is supposed to work better for individuals of less formal education. But it basically does similar things and includes an executive function test as part of the scoring. So what do we do when we think someone might have or has dementia? What do we test for? Are there things that are treatable? Everyone always checks vitamin B12, thyroid, and we think about depression. We test for that. Other tests that people may do, just standard blood tests, including syphilis, since neurosyphilis can present as dementia. Now, syphilis is increasingly rare in the United States and mostly in certain groups. But maybe 50 years ago, it was more common. Before penicillin, 60 years ago, more people may have gotten infected, never got too sick acutely, and then carried the treponeme and ended up with neurosyphilis. Again, all uncommon, but can happen. We rarely end up doing lumbar punctures now for that. And then neuroimaging is become an expectation. A CAT scan or a CT scan of the brain is helpful for acute problems, but usually we end up doing a magnetic resonance imaging or MRI, which is it go in the box and sit there for 45 minutes while they take images of your brain. But there's even fancier stuff coming down the pike. Symptomatic treatment are with these cholinesterase inhibitor drugs. These are the ones that change the balance of neurotransmitters in the brain. This is the basis of their development and approval. They are indicated for mild to moderate Alzheimer's. I personally think the evidence for their usefulness is reasonably good, but they're not, by any stretch of the imagination, a disease-modifying intervention or a cure or that everyone benefits. It does make some people better. And better over a period of time. And you think of it, it's slowing down the slope of decline, or sort of flattening the slope of decline. So for not everyone, but for some people. There are backup drugs besides donepezil, which is Aricept, and the first available one. They do have side effects, although they tend to be uncommon or mild. Things like diarrhea will keep people from taking the drug or nausea. The serious side effect is they can slow down the heart rate. So someone with a slow heart rate already, we have to watch it and take their electrocardiogram. But I have had patients do very nicely respond to these drugs, just as many who have not had a lot of response. Sometimes patients' caregiver is really the main outcome. We say, well, is they better? And they say, yes, okay, then we'll leave him on it because it seems like a mild, low-risk intervention once they've tolerated. There are data to support this. The endpoints have been institutionalization or progression of disability and no difference in this study. So it's mostly the important changes are caregiver perception and some slight decrease in the rate of decline of the mini-mental status exam. And so there are high-powered neurologists who run centers on Alzheimer's disease who have told me they're worthless. And then Dr. Miller, who runs our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, our memory center, everyone always gets a trial if we think they have Alzheimer's type dementia, and the patient is willing, because I have patients who say, no, I don't want to take medicine. I don't want a medicine. So that's fine, too. This is an imaging study, it should have been earlier, of what's coming in the future. These are PET scans, again, showing what we're learning about the brain. If you were thinking of, well, what is an MRI of a patient with dementia, what would it show that's worthwhile noting? Primarily, there are two things that people look for. One is loss of volume. So the brain itself shrinks, particularly around the temporal lobes, which would be in these areas here compared to so the shrinkage of the brain, of the actual tissue. And the other is multiple strokes, tiny strokes, what we call lacunar infarcts. They're white matter. They're part of the white matter of the brain. We see a lot of that, and we say, well, it's hypertension, it's cardiovascular risk factors. People with cognitive impairment have more of that, and those are the things that we tend to look for in an MRI. But there'll be other technology coming. You know it. It's part of what we live in. Final, I think, close to the final thing on dementia, as I'll mention, is the evaluation of driving risk. If I diagnose someone with Alzheimer's disease, they lose their driver's license. So this is a big deal for patients. And you say, well, that's the right thing to do. It's a safe thing to do. But boy, does it impact someone's self-esteem that they no longer can drive. And so it is we are obligated to report the patient to the DMV, and the DMV takes a few months, but they get the license back. Now, often families will say, "You're not driving anymore, Dad," and that's it. We're taking the car keys away, and that's more often than reporting and having it happen. But this is something that is part of what we deal with. And I had a physician patient with a fairly good mini mental score and a great response to Aricept. who lost her license. I actually wrote an appeal for her in her behalf, trying to be an air advocate, and she got turned down. She's adapted. She's doing fine with it, but it is something that we deal with. Now, prevention, since I was supposed to talk about prevention, so I knew there was more. Estrogen. In the Women's Health Initiative memory sub-study, this was looked at, randomized to estrogen and progesterone. This is systemic estrogen, so pills. Has no effect at all on topical vaginal estrogen. And there was no benefit of preventing probable dementia. And there is actually some data that would say that the combination would increase the risk of dementia. Now, we don't use estrogens very routinely anymore. In fact, we discourage its use as pills. But this is a data that is of no benefit in preventing dementia. Cholesterol-lowering drugs. Some people have said put them in the water. They're good for all these things. I'm not a believer in that. But people look at it because if you prevent strokes, you may prevent dementia. And like treating blood pressure, sometimes there's indication, yeah, you have less strokes, so maybe you have less dementia. But in the statin trials, no evidence that you prevent vascular dementia. These are large, well-done studies looking at cognitive function outcomes over a period of 3 to 5 years. Anti-inflammatory drugs. These are your naproxen, ibuprofen prototypes. Because, again, observational studies indicated, gee, there might be a benefit, and there might be some inflammation going on, so maybe we use these anti-inflammatory drugs, this would work. This kind of hypothesis has worked in other conditions. Again, randomized trial, volunteers, people over 70, naproxen, celecoxib, which is still in the market, and placebo. It was stopped after 3 years, no evidence of anti-inflammatory prevention benefits, and these drugs have significant side effects. They increase the clots, they can cause gastrointestinal bleeding. So I think that by what we know now, they probably wouldn't have been recommended for prevention of dementia. Sleep. This is kind of fun. So if you sleep better, you're likely to have better cognitive function. Is it really the chicken or the egg? And sort of a disruptive sleep has some cognitive effect. And so I think most people would identify with that. And so it sort of involves the importance of sleep. You don't need less sleep when you get older. You just sleep less. And sleep tends to be more disrupted. But this notion that, oh, I don't need as much sleep because now it's not true. And people should really strive to get to put their brain to rest over as long, aim for 8 hours. You won't get it, aim for 7, whatever. Get what you need, what you can, I should say. And then you avoid as much, you try to limit the disruption that happens. That is an effective aging. You have spent less time in stage 4 and you get more ups and downs, independent of urinary dysfunction, which we'll talk about. So leisure activities. This is an area of tremendous interest now. So there's trials that say that if you have people do like chess or some, Sudoku, other kinds of sort of mind-intensive activities that are easy, they're not, complex to get people to do, that you may improve cognitive function. And there are some hints that with people with mild cognitive impairment, they'll improve if you get them to do this repeatedly. Most of the literature would say that they learn the task well, but it doesn't change their longer-term outcome. And that's been the past evidence on this research. There's more current research that says that maybe actually you will impact their cognitive function. So this is, stay tuned. There might be a benefit for that. It kind of is some common sense behind it. Cognitive reserve is protective. There's a famous study probably published 20 years ago in JAMA or longer. There was a study of nuns who lived secluded lives, and they were evaluated at age 25. Their writing samples that they had done at age 25 was evaluated, and that was actually predictive of their development of cognitive impairment over their lifespan. And so this ability, so how much you build up in terms of your brain and, you know, forget it. It's a 25, you peak. After that, it's all downhill, right? But it isn't entirely that, but the point, and this is why education seems to matter so much. And people who have occupations that actually they're using their higher brain functions more consistently. And then there is the NeuroRacer, this video game that Adam Gazzelli, the neurologist here at UCSF, has developed, and others have published a couple years ago in the journal Nature, that you can, you know, you do these basic video games and you become more, you improve your cognitive function. Most of what they did was not in people who are very old. But it's an area of research that is taking off, and I think there may be something to pursue there that would be actually applicable on a wide scale, because you can do this through internet or through online programs. So I think this is an area of promise. But finally, I will say that exercise and the physical activity actually does work. And the data on this, I think, are pretty robust. Now, you can't do a randomized trial. You don't exercise, you exercise. So we don't have that kind of evidence. But huge observational studies that adjust for all the confounders that may be happening. The first time I heard about this 20 years ago, I said, well, what about social interactions? People are exercising. They're more likely to be talking and interacting. Doesn't that help? But it clearly is very consistent. So high level of physical activity is protective. And the hazard ratio means, well, what's the decrease? So this is a protection. So one would be the what would happen if you had no exercise. And this is like almost a 40% decrease in cognitive decline. On measures that are mediating measures, not necessarily the event of dementia. So, and in today, someone diagnosed with cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's disease, the main treatment, other than a couple of pills that we think might help, that every neurologist in the memory center will say is physical activity. That will help you. And it helps your brain. And the connection there is, the pathway there is not clear. But the observational data, I think, are fairly robust. And so this is, again, another reason why we have to stay active. If you look at the final point about prevention is staying positive, the impact that you could have with things that we all know about, we can do better with education, right? We can get people not to smoke. We can get people physically active. We can manage depression. We can avoid issues around midlife. And actually, midlife is a good time to do modifiable. You can sort of, you know, hit 40 or 50 and then start to change and still get benefit. And diabetes. So I think this is an area that these are known things as opposed to what's the newfangled vitamin that I can take or this product that I can buy that will make my memory better. Okay, let's go on to more mundane topics. Falls. Everyone falls, right? But in older adults, this is a really important problem, a really important problem. And one of the things that I kind of catch myself always thinking when I'm seeing my 80-year-olds is ask, did you have any falls? They don't always volunteer, so you have to find out about it. So it causes deaths, hospitalizations. Latinos have a higher rate. This is data from California where you had these data. Tons of ER visits. Serious falls-related injuries. The most important one is hip fracture, which has a 20% mortality at 1 year. Now, frequently people are very sick already. Non-hip fractures are common. Traumatic brain injury, hemorrhage is uncommon, but can be catastrophic. And then chest injuries, so rib fractures, that's not uncommon and very painful. And then worsening of that, puncturing a lung or hemorrhaging into a lung, which can be more serious. So this is a serious problem. People who fall and become unstable or unsteady in their gait then become restrict their activity. They're afraid. They're afraid to go out. They're afraid to act, to walk, because they're worried about falling again. And so this has secondary consequences, even if their fall didn't lead to a problem. Many of the people who fall, a third, require help with their activities of daily living. Of course, there's increased risk of going to a nursing home. And this fear of falling is a problem. Once someone has a problem with falls, or they fall and they fracture, and then they become increasingly isolated and less likely to be active. And they just refuse. They say, no, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. And no one can convince them. So this is something that ideally we'll address by preventing falls and being aware of this. So what's a risk factor for fall? This is in a research statistical analysis of a likelihood ratio. So the number means the risk of this happening in the last year. So if you have a fall in the previous year, you're 3.8 more times to fall this year. So one fall last year will lead to higher risk. Having what we call orthostatic hypotension, which means your blood pressure drops when you stand up suddenly and you get dizzy, which is not uncommon, doesn't increase risk. People don't usually fall when that happens. They just feel, oh, I think I'm going to fall, but they're fine. They don't usually fall. Having cataracts or visual acuity impairment actually is protective from falls. And what happens is people just don't do as much. Because they can't, they're impaired. The big problem of gait and balance. So trouble walking or trouble with your balance is a risk. It doubles the risk. At UCSF, the physical therapy department has created a gait and balance sort of clinic or intervention where they will one or two sessions with patients to help them with their gait and their balance for whatever reason they're having trouble. Being on medications may lead to falls. Cognition, impaired cognition is the biggest risk. And then if you already have limitation in activities of daily living or instrumental activities of daily living, that will also be an increased risk for falls. Again, all things that as doctors, except maybe for medications, is not things that we routinely are focused on in the traditional medical model. But this is so critically important in older adults. Gait abnormalities are common. Over half of adults over 85 will report some trouble with walking. Gait speed, as I alluded to earlier, actually predicts 10-year mortality. I'm moving our practice to sort of do this as a standard test in everybody, maybe starting at age 75 or 80 or something, and I think we're moving in that direction. This gait balance test. And a risk of multiple falls in one study, one survey from California Health Interview Survey found that Latinos were at higher risk of multiple falls. I don't know why this is the case. I'm just reporting that. But you can see that over 64, it's not uncommon. 8 to 17% of adults reported multiple falls. So what do the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommend? So exercise and physical therapy reduces falls. The more the better, and the evidence is strong. Vitamin D works, and no one knows why. Now, some scientists think that this will not hold up with more scrutiny, but it has made it to the task force, and the task force is really rigorous when they recommend something. And the data say that if you give some supplemental vitamin D, and probably 1,000 international units is sufficient, you decrease the risk of falls. So in my way of thinking, that means most people at age 65, or everybody at age 65, should start taking vitamin D supplements. And it's not the bones. It's not for bones. It's for preventing falls. Vision correction shows no reduction, although we do that for other reasons. And there are now these programs that are being tested in different community clinic settings or practice settings of multifactorial interventions, trying to combine all these things and more, although this, to date they have not been shown to reduce falls in a statistically significant way. So the consequence of falls is fractures, and you fracture when your bones are weak. And so what is osteoporosis? Osteoporosis is, in adults, we're constantly renovating bone. It's being removed and replaced. And it is loss of mineral and structural integrity. So you lose the mineral content. That's what we measure with the bone density test. But there's also changes in architecture of the bone, which is part of what happens when you take the main pharmacological treatment for it. And fractures are common. So these two things are related. Falls leads to potential fractures, and older adults will fracture more commonly because their bones are becoming more osteoporotic or weaker. And that's just a way of thinking of it. It's a structural problem, like the beam in your house is just not as strong because of rot or something. Trauma, of course, matters. So if you have enough severe trauma, you're going to fracture. But in some ways, there is no threshold for skeletal fragility, and the weaker the bone, the less trauma required to fracture. You'd be surprised what sometimes people will fracture an ankle when they just misstep off a curb. A very certain move will lead to a rib fracture. It is not necessarily a car accident or falling down the stairs. So what are risk factors for fracture? Older age, women after menopause, and being of white or East Asian race. This is definitely risk factors. Other important factors are family history, low body weight, being a smoker, drinking 3 drinks per day. It's a continuous risk, so that's much higher than the recommended amount or maximum amount. Certain drugs and diseases, you know, prednisone or corticosteroids will decrease the bone strength. Certain diseases will also lead to secondary osteoporosis, but that's a smaller part of the whole pie. And then having a previous fracture automatically means that you're at increase for another one because you've already shown some fragility. And the highest risk is in that first year or so after the first fracture. There is a test, most of you probably have heard of this, bone mineral density, which also goes by the name DEXA, D-X-A, that strongly predicts fracture. So let me, this is what a machine would look like. It's just an X-ray, but it's a quantitative X-ray, so you need an appointment for it, can't just walk in. And they measure the mineral content of the bone, the mineral content of calcium. It is kind of a confusing report now that we have, you get your reports of your tests, doctor sends them to you, or you see them online, you say, what does this all mean? It took years to teach doctors how to interpret these things. It is based on a evaluation relative to a young adult sample. So we used to say 25, a 30-year-old is sort of the peak bone mass. And you say, that's the reference point that we're measuring it. And then you get a statistic that gets reported that is giving us a deviation from that normal. Now, no one is going to stay the way they were at 30, right? So you're going to go down somewhat. So -1 or being greater than -1 is actually normal. If you're between -1 and -2.5, we now call that low bone mass. It used to be called osteopenia. Osteopenia should be discarded as a term because it implies that it's a disease. It isn't. It's just a risk of your bone is getting thinner. And the cut point for osteoporosis is -2.5, predominantly defined in the femoral neck, although people will call it if it's in the spine or in the total femur. Femur is the hip, the bone coming out of the hip into your thigh. Large studies show this increases fractures in both women and men. Because this has been predominantly an issue among women, most of the knowledge that we have is on women. But clearly, men also get osteoporotic and potentially would benefit from intervention. So it's just not as advanced, the knowledge and the recommendations. And the coverage by Medicare is not the same. So this is an illustration done by our former chief, Steve Cummings, many years ago to illustrate this. This is the hip fracture risk if you're in the lower third of bone density and have your hip fracture rate, you see, is quite low, and your number of risk factors are low, 0 to 2. More risk factors, low bone density, your risk of hip fracture goes way up. So these are not additive. They tend to act in a synergistic way. Perhaps not unlike some of the charts that Bobby Barron may have showed you around cholesterol and risk of heart attack. So who should get a DEXA, this bone density test? It is currently recommended that all women be tested at age 65. A lot of women get them earlier, but this is the official recommendation. You would recommend women younger than 65 if they have fracture risk based on family history or other risk factors, smoker, very thin, certain medications. You know, people with certain diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, would probably get them earlier. It is usually covered by insurance as a screening test, and again, repeat it again if you're going to repeat it. It is not, however, Medicare has not approved it for men, even though there are now reasonably strong data that we should also be screening men probably at age 70, a little bit older, just to see where they are with their bone mass. And the only way you can get a test like this for a man with Medicare is if you have a diagnosis of a disease, like low testosterone, or they're on prednisone, or they have rheumatoid arthritis, or some other reason why you're checking it, or they're getting treated with medicines that will potentially decrease the bone mass. So this is an illustration of what the bone mass could mean in a 50-year-old woman. So if you do this test in a 50-year-old woman, 5-year risk of hip fracture is really low, no matter what your bone density is. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to start taking a drug every week to prevent that risk. Your lifetime risk is high. So the sweet spot is find out when you need to intervene to prevent the fractures. And so it is, and the answer to that is older. If you go at age 70, now you see a 5-year risk if you really if your bone density is really low, like here, -3. Now you're talking about a 9% risk of hip fracture. Even a 4% risk of hip fracture becomes significant, and you're saying, "Huh, we better do something about this if we can." And there's actually good evidence for certain kinds of medications to use. There is, again, available on the web, you don't need to be a doctor to do this, so you need to know what to do, where you can do a calculation of absolute fracture risk. And like heart disease prevention, we want to not just say, okay, this is your test result, take this drug. We want to sort of weigh all these things into consideration. Age and weight, you can see here, the goes as previous fracture risks and family history, current smoking. And it spits out a risk of a major osteoporotic fracture as well as a hip fracture. And then there'll be thresholds. 20% risk of a 10-year probability of any fracture may be a reason to say, okay, it's time to use a medicine. Or even a 3% risk of a hip fracture will be a time to use a medicine, since that's such bad consequences. This is a model of how you can think of this. So it isn't just the magical bone mineral density score, but it's your age and the number of risk factors where you use different thresholds to decide on treatment. And this is the movement that we need to incorporate in managing osteoporosis, as opposed to, so you screen someone at 50, you rarely are ever going to recommend anything pharmacological or say anything other than the stuff that we've already talked about: exercise, don't smoke, you know, control your, you know, don't drink in excess, and watch how, you know, make sure if you have trouble walking that we address that. Versus at age 70 or 80, when this risk becomes much higher, and the consequences of a major fracture are enormously greater, and also much more common. So I think that's the message I'm trying to transmit here. What about interval screening? So if you get one bone density, should you, the report often says, get another one in 2 years. And there's really not a strong, there's a lot of evidence to do it. The official recommendation is just to do one, but most doctors end up doing more than one. There's no strong guidelines. However, the study of osteoporosis fractures, again, done, coordinated out of UCSF, looked at their data of what happened to women who got different levels of bone density at 2, 6, 10, and 16 years. Because in a research study, they were getting all these tests. And whether or not these interval to transition from normal to low bone mass to osteoporosis. And these were the results that were in the New England Journal a couple of years ago. So if you're normal, so greater than -1, so think reverse, right? So 0 to -1 or above 0, your risk for getting osteoporosis is minimal. So maybe, you know, at age 65, you get this result. You say, well, we can wait till you're 80 to do another one, if ever. If you're kind of like normal but low normal, you know, -1 to 1.5, your risk now, 15-year risk for osteoporosis was 5%. So the time to see where you get 10% of these women go to below -0.5 was 17 years. So again, you can say 65 and again at 80, that seems to make sense to me. That's how I interpret these data. But if you get into the area of closer to what we call now low bone mass, now you have some evidence that doing a repeat either at 2 years to see that there is stability or at 5 years makes more sense. These are not official recommendations. These are just my interpretation or in some interpretation of published data. But frequently you see these knee-jerk, oh, get another one, and you don't really need them because they're not really going to change what you end up doing. Nor do you need one after you start treatment. So these are some, I just said most of these things that are put here. And the only caution is, in this study was based that half of the participants in this study had osteoporosis. So this is a subpart of that group that did not to begin with in the study. Osteoporosis, though, is underrecognized. Doctors aren't doing enough diagnosis for it. One study from the VA, 12 months after a hip fracture, only 2% had a bone density test and only 15% with appropriate drug. The idea, I think, there is, so already, you know, the sort of the horse out of the barn kind of mentality, the bad thing already happened, why bother? And the reality is, no, those are the highest yield benefit. If you get a fracture, that's the group that benefits the most from pharmacological treatment. And so this is, again, something to focus on. It is popular to... So what do we do about workup? So if someone has osteoporosis, do we worry about what else could be going on? Make sure that someone is in vitamin D deficient in a serious way. Vitamin D has become quite a hot topic in the last decade. It's kind of losing it a little bit, fortunately. But it's still worthwhile checking it. It cycles during the year. If you take a dark-skinned person and test them in December, they're going to be low, I can guarantee you. But test them in July, and they're going to be normal. They don't absorb the sun. There is no sun in some parts of the country in December. And so I think those are all variables that we understand a lot more about. There are some diseases characterized by elevated calcium, kidney dysfunction, or dysfunctional thyroid, so excess thyroid hormone that would lead to osteoporosis and are worth testing for. Probably routinely in everyone who you diagnose with osteoporosis. Things like SPRU serology, which is an antibody test, or looking for multiple myeloma by doing these blood tests and urine tests isn't necessarily necessary. And checking for parathyroid hormone, if the serum calcium is normal, is not worth doing. So the serum calcium test is a screener for a parathyroid hormone elevation, which would be caused by a tumor of that gland in the neck, which can cause severe osteoporosis. So osteoporosis is silent until something bad happens, so you actually don't have any symptoms from osteoporosis most of the time until you fracture. And that could be a vertebral fracture, so a vertebra collapsing, or the bad one of the hip fracture. Everyone should receive these lifestyle nutritional counseling. And then, again, the FRAX calculator is available at that website. So who should be treated? This is preventive medicine for everyone. So adequate calcium intake in your diet is the best way to get calcium. I am not going to make a big deal about taking supplemental calcium, and I'll come back to that. Vitamin D for everyone for other reasons, but also make sure that you usually calcium and vitamin D go together. Physical activity or exercise, no tobacco, limit alcohol. Those are basics. And then who do you offer drug treatment, pharmacological treatment for? Anyone with fracture or the T-score under minus 2.5 or the high 10-year fracture risk of 20% or 3% hip fracture, using that calculator, even if they don't meet the minus 2.5 on the bone density test. So this is the science behind these recommendations of telling someone, you feel okay, but we're going to tell you to take a medicine, so medicalizing normality. I think I went through these already. Sorry, these are redundant, so physical activity. There are these studies done on hip protector pads. They're really not preventing osteoporosis or preventing fracture. The problem is no one would wear them. So they kind of fell out of favor. Good studies showed they prevented fractures, but in very high-risk persons. Calcium and vitamin D are worth mentioning because about everybody thinks they should take calcium and vitamin D. So the data for using calcium and vitamin D to prevent fractures and treat osteoporosis comes from a very well done study done 20 years ago in patients who were, first of all, grossly vitamin D deficient, and second, in a nursing home. So if you're frail and restricted in your activities, like someone in a nursing home, most people in a nursing home are, maybe that calcium and vitamin D is a good way to go to start with. But I would argue that you probably are better off taking calcium in your diet as in part of your nutrition rather than as a supplement. If you can't do it as that, then take it as a supplement. And there are other negative studies done more recently that show that this really doesn't impact the outcome of fractures unless, you start with very frail, non-mobile elderly women who are vitamin D deficient. So a lot of the experts in this area at the scientific level have really sort of downgraded the whole issue of giving people calcium supplements. If you are going to take it in your diet, this is the recommended dose for women is 1,200 milligrams per day, and for men over 70. The vitamin D, we definitely no more than 4,000. There's going to be a trial that the National Institute on Aging has is going to fund or has already funded to look at different dosing of vitamin D. I'm not convinced that more than 2,000 a day is of any benefit, but they'll be testing that, and 1,000 is usually what I would recommend. If you take it in diet, 600 to 800 units is sufficient. And the serum levels, everybody gets tested. The normal is more than 20, and yet our labs are saying 30. And so a lot of people were in their 20s, and that's perfectly fine. And now, thanks in part to Bobby's lobbying with them, the Institute of Medicine recommended 20, and so they've changed the normal range to be 20. And the non-skeletal benefits have not been established. So did vitamin D prevent heart attacks? No. Did vitamin D prevent cancer? No. Does it prevent strokes? No. None of that data has panned out. So if you want to waste money, buy and take it for other reasons or take other things. But it's probably not harmful in moderate doses. But this is clearly different rages that go on with different things. These are the recommendations from the Preventive Task Force. I already talked about them. You give vitamin D to prevent falls. And these are the fractures. They're saying don't go above a certain dose. But I'll skip over this. Let me talk about the bisphosphonates. So we also have time for urine. These drugs worked better than anyone ever expected. So they're kind of an interesting drug. So people are saying, well, if you change bone density this much, you'll prevent this much fractures. And when they actually did the original trials, which Steve Cummings was one of the trials that they did, coordinated out of San Francisco, they had a 50% reduction in fractures. So this is dramatic impact on fractures. So they say, well, we don't know why, actually. We don't really know why these drugs work so well. They do something to bone architecture. They're not just increasing mineral density. So they became big. And they actually, once you take them, they stay with you forever. They get deposited in bone, and they're there for decades. So if you take them at 65, it's likely that you're going to take them with you. There are four approved agents. They've never been tested head-to-head, but we assume they're all similar. The trials have been pretty similar. Alendronate and resedronate, which are the first two, have the most trial data. Behind them, ibandronate is the one you can give once a month, and solindronic acid has a strong trial in favor of it. It's very potent and is given as an IV infusion once a year. It does reduce fractures by a significant amount. And people with existing vertebral fractures or low bone density are the strongest indications to use it, and is not necessarily be useful if the bone mineral density is higher. This is an example of the original studies. This is a chart that shows the effects of the trial. So I realize this is more of a scientific. This is not a scientific presentation. So this little diamond here is a summary of the effect. If something is less than one, it's protective. So it's decreasing the event that we're interested in, which is a fracture, a non-spine fracture. So this shows that there was a 31% reduction of non-spine fractures when your bone mineral density was this low. However, if your bone mineral density was what we now call low bone mass, this -1.5 to -2.5, there really was no benefit. It was the same thing as one. So there was no impact on fractures. So there's no benefit to starting early. Oh, yeah, if it works for this much, it'll work even better. No, it doesn't. That logic doesn't work. And you can see the overall effect was barely not statistically significant because you factored in these women. These are all done with women that did not really need them. This is a study with resedronate, similar kind of data, looking at women with the score was -3 on their bone density, so really have a clear-cut osteoporosis, 39% decrease in incidence of hip fractures. And the group of women who, all over 80, risk factors for hip fracture, but no osteoporosis on bone density, there was no effect on their hip fracture. So again, there is logic behind the rationale for recommending these drugs. What has happened with these bisphosphonates is that they are hard to take. You have to take them fasting and remain sitting up for 30 minutes. The stomach has to be empty, and you take them with water. Because if you get any food in the stomach, the absorption is not very good, and your benefit is decreased. They can cause esophagitis or heartburn or inflammation of the esophagus and stomach, and especially, and this is not an uncommon side effect. So a lot of people stop taking it, and daily dosing, only a little over half continue doing it. It's maybe not that different to other preventive treatment, although I think we do better than that in hypertension, but it is something, and that is prevention. It is multiple practice settings have shown this, so it's a problem. So people developed, scientists said, well, these drugs will work if you give them weekly. And so the whole notion that if you gave them weekly, you would get the same benefit, and you do. You just add up the dose, and you take one pill once a week. If you do it monthly, they may not improve adherence, but it is, I think, just a different way of doing it. And there are fewer side effects if you get 52 doses a year as opposed to 365. So that's generally what most of us now do, is we start off with weekly dosing in patients. And the zoledronate is once a year. Doug Bauer, who's our faculty, who is really the expert on osteoporosis in our group, in our division, says he's doing more and more of this. And I actually have about three patients I'm lining up for this. Who I say, well, they won't take a pill, but I say, well, how about an IV infusion once a year? He goes, oh, yeah, maybe I'll do that. So I think for either adherence or just frailty, multiple pills already in someone who's 85, 90 years old, had fractures, and you want them to be protected, this is one way to go. Just to pause for a moment, a little, be careful about new drugs, right? We used to always say, well, I'll wait till it's been used for a while before I go to the new drugs. You know, there are always exceptions. We jump on the bandwagon when there were new drugs for HIV back in the day, but I think now it's up. So let's finish up with a little bit on bladder function. Not a fun topic, right? But common. So most, again, an issue that has been addressed with women, but I will bring this back to men at the end. So the idea is, well, incontinence or leakage of urine it just happens when you get old, right? I mean, this is just known. And reality is it happens at all ages. You can see here in this study, 27,000 women, you can see it's a lower rate at 20 to 24, but not insignificant, even in 40, 44, 25%. And certainly when you get to 90, you're getting up to 40%. So there is a slight age relationship, but it's not an inevitable consequence of aging. And by incontinence, I'm referring to leakage, loss of urine, not necessarily dysfunction in urine, which is important to differentiate. So what happens when you age? And this is, again, focused on women. But it applies to men as well, as I'll point out. So involuntary bladder muscle contraction. So when you want to urinate, the bladder sends a signal to the brain, says, hey, I need to urinate. I need to get empty. So it's either because it's so full that you're feeling it, or the bladder just decides it's time to go, and starts contracting. No, this is funny, but it's part of what happens. And the bladder, the brain can overcome that, right? The brain can just say, hey, no, I can't do it now. I got to wait till I get to the bathroom. So, okay, fine. We'll deal with this. But as you age, actually the ability of the brain to dominate the bladder kind of goes down. The bladder gets a little bit more independent and wants to do it when it wants to do it. And it wants to empty when it has not that much urine. So, you know, it's not like, you know, if you put half a liter of urine into anyone's bladder, you're going to have discomfort and you're going to want to empty it. But 100, 150 milliliters is not that much. I mean, yeah, you can empty it, but it's not like, oh, I gotta go. And that's what, so that's part of what happens. And this is very common. It happens in both men and women. It is a consequence of aging because the brain connections to controlling the body decrease with age. It's not universal, but that is one of the things that happens. And teaching someone to control that is a challenge if they're cognitively impaired. And this is where incontinence becomes a $1 billion industry of, you know, pads and diapers and supplies that people get. Atrophy of the urethral mucosa. So women have a very short urethra. So the bladder to the outside distance is short. In men, there's this thing called a prostate that obstructs the way. So usually the problem with men is the pipe is obstructed and you have a hard time getting the urine out. And in women is too much, you know, it leaks. That's the sort of the general, although both can happen in both genders. But the muscles around the urethra, which sits just in next to the vagina, just above it, in looking at it from a pelvic exam perspective and sort of closer to the head from your body, gets atrophied with time because you lose estrogen. So the estrogen tone that you have to the vaginal area actually affects the muscles around the urethra because they're right next to each other. And that urethra then has less tightness of the muscle control of urine. And so that's also what's going on here, this atrophy with aging and loss in postmenopausal women. In men, that doesn't happen, obviously, but the other problem is the pipes get stuck with getting through the prostate. And this is treatable with topical estrogens, for example, which is probably almost certainly harmless in terms of all the bad things that we know estrogens can do, and yet often can make a difference in some women. This overactivity of the detrusor muscle is in fact a bladder muscle. It's a smooth muscle, so it's not a voluntary muscle like your arm where you say, okay, I want to move it. This is involuntary muscle like the ones you breathe, and so it does have that kind of ability to just take off. The sphincter that holds things in gets deficient, and the pelvic floor gets weak. And all these things then lead to increased likelihood. And then you add to that chronic things like mobility impairment. So someone needs to go to the bathroom, but they, you know, it hurts. They just have a time getting up, so they just, you know, let it go. And I think that contributes to it. And this is and then cognitive impairment will lead to this functional incontinence. It is by far the most common thing that we see as underlying need for all these supplies for women, for persons with incontinence. There, in incontinence, we use the term stress, urge, and mixed. Stress incontinence means you lose urine, and this is women, when you're walking up the stairs, running, coughing. And it is predominantly driven by weakness of the pelvic musculature and this atrophy. Sometimes you see it as a consequence postpartum, after giving birth. In fact, it's not that uncommon, and then it usually gets better because all the hormonal environment changes, especially if women are breastfeeding. Urge is gotta go. It's that bladder muscle contracting, and you have this sense that if you don't go rapidly, you're going to have an accident. And reality is that the faster you go to the bathroom, the more likely you're going to have an accident. And then mix, which is unfortunately a lot of what we see. And you can figure these out doing tests where you put in probes and measure pressures, although it's not clinically necessary to do that. Most of the time, you can get a pretty good sense on the basis of history of patients. There are consequences. If you do C-section on a woman, their risk of incontinence later is higher as vaginal delivery versus no delivery and vaginal delivery versus C-section. Giving birth, this is one of the consequences later in life of having children. This is in relationship to obesity. Women who are obese very severely obese are more likely to have incontinence. And if actually you treat that and they lose weight, you decrease the incontinence. So this is an area of active research that has been done. Diabetes also increases risk of urinary incontinence. In one observational study, the Nurses Health Study, it increases with duration of diabetes. And here it can be complicated because bladders, you can get bladder function effects of diabetes, or the nervous system is affected. So the bladder is filling up and not sensing that it needs to go. So you end up with what we call neurogenic bladder and overflow incontinence, and that can be a consequence of diabetes, as well as damage to innervation of the urethra and increased volume of urine. The best treatment for urgency incontinence is behavioral. And there's these exercises called Kegels, which you probably have all heard of. It's pelvic floor muscle exercises, optimally taught by someone who spends, you know, 10 to 20 minutes in a pelvic exam scenario, showing a woman exactly what muscles they need to contract and relax. And there are usually, I think, nurse practitioners who are experts at this that we can refer to. Bladder training, which is getting someone to urinate every 2 hours, for example, whether you feel like you need to go or not, as a way to train your bladder to go when you say it's time to go, not when the bladder wants to go. And then urge suppression. And urge suppression is important. You got to teach the patients to do this. These are Kegels exercises. I'm just going to skip this for interest of time. But bladder training, it's the urge, you know, you void every hour. I say usually 2 hours. Every hour, so patients don't kind of roll their eyes when I say that. Progressively increase the interval, and then you get to where they have better command. And this is a way of training it. And then urge, the main thing is you don't run to the bathroom. That's the worst thing to do. You got to sit down, take a deep breath, learn how to do relaxation exercise for just a few seconds, and then when you kind of are letting that wave of urge go, then you get up calmly and go to the bathroom. And it actually works. People do learn how to do this. And you control that urge, but going in a hurry, you just have no control, and inevitably you have more leakage that way. Variety of ways of extending evaluations. Allison Wong, who is also in our faculty, has developed these three questions. It's kind of hard to read here, but they're bolded. During the last 3 months, have you leaked urine even a small amount? During the last 3 months, have you leaked urine when you were performing physical activity, urge? This is to distinguish urge and stress. And then asking when you were performing certain things, leaked most often. Women who have a lot of incontinence will have 15, 20 episodes a week. But most patients will say, well, you know, it happens a couple times a week, or maybe once a day or something like that. And then to do an intervention to decrease that, you need really to have an impact on frequency. To give a drug for that, they either have to be on a very extreme level or have no ability to learn how to do the behavioral changes. Behavioral changes have been tested in randomized trials, and they work. These are a list of all the medicines that we use. They're muscarinic agents. The main side effect they have is they can cause dry mouth. That's the most common one. Oxybutynin, which is this one, also does the trade name, is listed here in extended release, is the only one that's less expensive because it's generic. But there are a variety of other options that can be tried. And often a small dose, 5 or 10 milligrams, will help someone have better control, because what it does is it works on the bladder muscle, so it stabilizes the muscle, so it doesn't have this overactivity happen as often. Therefore, it is actually potentially useful in men who have an overactive bladder as well, as opposed to just used in women. There are a variety of things that we need to watch out for. I always start with a very low dose, and I rarely go with more than 10 milligrams of oxybutynin. There are ways to prevent dry mouth. It is, after all, not that serious a side effect. You can have people do lozenges or chew sugar-free gum if they're willing to do that. So let's finish up with a couple things about men. I'm going to just refocus on the overactive bladder. Men also get this. I have a patient in my office last year who said, I'm getting up 15 times at night. I can't sleep. So it's disruptive to their sleep. And yet when we evaluated them, prostate wasn't the problem. The prostate was actually kind of normal in size. So it isn't like, I can't urinate, doctor. I can't get the urine out. I have to push it. No, it was just, I'm getting up 15 times at night. So it was an overactive bladder with a normal or expected, you know, maybe a little bit big prostate, but that wasn't the symptom that was being presented. And again, the same principles would work. Bladder training, urge suppression, and a small dose of these anti-muscarinic drugs. And the prevalence of these overactive bladders are actually not that different between men and women. We probably are much more sensitive to asking women about it and thinking men about obstruction rather than this. Also limiting fluid, some common sense things like avoiding caffeine and alcohol at night, the time you give someone a water pill, a diuretic, and then the whole issue of how people sleep. I think we went through these already. I borrowed this from a surgeon. There are these nerve stimulation and sacral nerve stimulation and actually botulinum toxin that can be injected into the bladder, which has been approved for the interventionist types. Either a urologist will do this or patients who want these kinds of intervention. And there is some benefit. There is good efficacy results. It only lasts 6 months, so I think you still need to go through the behavioral change. So it's not a way to avoid behavioral change. So let me stop. So thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.